Well, as you know from your program, in this session I want to discuss specifically the evidence related to the origin of man, namely the fossil record as it relates to the origin of man and origin of primates and so forth. Now, we maintain, of course, that you can establish from the fossil record and from the laws of thermodynamics and things like this that animals and plants could not have evolved. Well, it follows then man did not evolve, because man is supposed to be the apex, the final created entity, and if animals didn't evolve, then man didn't evolve. Of course, we're all interested in the subject of man, and we are all familiar with the many publications from Time Life and other sources which give these highly imaginative transitional forms based upon a tooth, a fragment of a jaw, or a piece of a skull, or some combination of some sort. And it all seems so convincing, and here's a real live proof of evolution. You see the brochure produced by Time Life to advertise their books on the origin of man. This fold out, and here you start with the apes, and then you show the creatures getting more and more upright and more man-like, and finally you have man on the other side, and it just really, it looks so convincing, and you see these on the bulletin boards of high schools and so forth, and I'm sure it just immediately convinced many of these young people that evolution is a fact. So we want to take a look at some of that evidence this afternoon, and I'd like to begin by emphasizing the tremendous influence of preconceived ideas on the study of human origins. Now, as I mentioned this morning, we all have preconceived ideas when it comes to origins. Even if you don't have any preconceived ideas, if you're going to be completely open and objective, when you go to talk to someone, you are talking to someone who has preconceived ideas and prejudices and biases. That's particularly true in origins, and specifically true in the case of the origin of man. And I want to give a couple of illustrations where the influence of preconceived ideas has misled evolutionists. You know, I find in my experience that evolutionists often get angry when I do this. They just don't like it. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't like it either, because it's very embarrassing to evolutionists. But nevertheless, it is true. It did happen. And I think it has a great value in illustrating to us how fallible man is. Even the most careful scientists, the ones with the greatest reputation, have accepted fraudulent evidence. They have accepted evidence that turned out to be absolutely, completely wrong. The first case I want to bring to your attention is that of the Piltdown Man. Back in about 1912 or so, they discovered a piece of a jaw in a gravel pit near Piltdown, England. Later on, they found a couple of three teeth and a few fragments of a skull. The discoverer, or the man to whom these finds were reported, was Charles Dawson, an amateur paleontologist. Dawson brought this material to Arthur Smith Woodward, director of the British Museum. Now, the jawbone did appear to be quite ape-like, but yet the teeth were remarkably man-like. And they appeared to be quite old. The fragments of the skull also appeared to be quite old, quite man-like, but yet they could detect primitive features in the skull and advanced features in the jaw. And Sir Arthur Smith Woodward and Charles Dawson published a joint paper on this creature. They put the jaw and the fragments of the skull together and called this Eanthropus Dawsoni, or Dawson's Don Man, the earliest Englishman, our subhuman ancestor. He became known popularly as Piltdown Man. Subsequently, over 500 books and pamphlets were written on Piltdown Man. And he was portrayed by many of the world's greatest experts as undoubtedly our ancestor, our subhuman ancestor, about a half a million years old that he was just to be. Well, about 1950, they had developed a method for dating bones. not an absolute dating method. They couldn't put an absolute age on anything by this method, but they could tell you whether this bone is as old as that bone, if they're dug out of the same soil, if they've been there the same length of time. This is based upon the rate of uptake of fluoride from the soil. Bones absorb fluoride from the soil, and the longer they've been there, the more fluoride they have in them. Now, some soils don't have any fluoride, and so you cannot use it in an absolute dating method. Well, they applied the method to the jawbone and to the skull, and they found, alas, the jawbone had no fluoride in it at all. It was no fossil. It hadn't been in there any earlier than 1910, the year it was found. Couldn't possibly be a fossil. The skull was quite a bit older than that, but certainly not the 500,000 years that they had estimated. Well, with this information at hand, then, the scientists did what they should have done in the first place. They checked the specimens much more carefully. They found that the bones had been treated chemically to make them look old, and the teeth had been filed with a file to make them look manlike. They could detect scratch marks from a file in the teeth. In other words, Piltdown Man was a 100% fraud. Somebody had taken a modern ape's jaw, the jaw of a chimpanzee, and had taken a recent human skull and had doctored up those bones and had planted the bones in the gravel pit and fooled the world's greatest experts. Now, why was the fraud successful? It wasn't a very clever fraud, we are told. The fraud was successful because this is what the scientists wanted to find. This is what they had expected to find. And this is indeed what they found. On the first slide, please, we'll show the reconstruction of Piltdown Man, which appeared in Life magazine. Now I'm going to have the lights off, please. May we have the lights turned off? I suppose somebody... Do we have somebody to turn the lights off? All right, I see somebody's going up to turn the lights off. We get the lights off, Charlie, you'll be able to see this. I obtained this picture from from Life magazine, 1937 issue of Life magazine. Here's the famous Piltdown Man, and this is what appeared in our books for about a half a century. 500 books and pamphlets written on this creature. Here he is, the famous Piltdown Man, turned out to be a modern ape's jaw and a recent human skull. Just an outright fraud, but a fool the world's greatest experts. The reason was, you see, this is what they had expected to find. This is what they wanted to find. And so, this is what they found. A very, very human failing. Now, another example is that of the famous Nebraska Man. Back in about 1922, they found a tooth out in western Nebraska. And it was brought to the attention of Henry Fairfield Osborne, W.K. Gregory, and other experts on fossil primates and man and so forth, and they were very excited by the discovery of this tooth. This tooth seemed to have the morphological characteristic that they would associate with primitive man, or at least some higher primate of some kind. And the discussion was whether this creature was an ape-like man or a man-like ape, which side of the line to place the creature. The Illustrated London News had their artist draw a picture of this famous Nebraska Man, as he was called, based upon the descriptions of Osborne and others. And the next slide will show the picture of the Nebraska Man. All right, here is the picture then of the man and of his wife and of the tools that they used and the general cultural setting of these creatures, all based upon a single tooth. You know, someone has said that science is such a fascinating subject. You can get such wholesale production of conjectures from just a trifling investment of facts. And this is a glaring example. All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to emphasize, this is a picture of our subhuman ancestor that you would have been presented in the 1920s. This was a picture, or this was a creature, it was flaunted in the face of William Jennings Bryan at the time of the Scopes trial. Here's evidence from your own home state for the origin of man. All right, here he is, the famous Nebraska Man. Well, after a few more years of research and discoveries, they recovered the remainder of the creature, the postcranial skeleton of this creature. And as related in this article I have here from December 16, 1927, which appeared in Science, this creature was apparently not a man nor an ape. He turned out to be a pig. That's right. The tooth, they turned out to be a pig's tooth. A tooth from an extinct peccary. But now, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to look carefully at that picture now. That's a picture of our subhuman ancestor based upon a pig's tooth. As I often point out, I think this is a case where a pig made a monkey out of a scientist. And the Piltdown man, that's the case where an ape made a monkey out of a scientist. But now, remember, ladies and gentlemen, the picture of Piltdown man based upon a modern ape's jaw and a recent human skull. Nebraska man based upon a pig's tooth. Now, you see, this simply because this is what these people expected to find, what they wanted to find, you see, and so this is what they tended to find. Now, the reason I illustrate this is because it would make all of us cautious about what scientists tell us, or their reconstructions, or their models, based upon some this extremely fragmentary evidence that is available. I say this, if they can get a man from a pig's tooth, and a man from an ape's jaw, they get a man from anything. And so I think we are entitled to be skeptical about this material. Now, another reason that we should be careful is because the evidence is extremely fragmentary, and the less evidence you have, the more imagination you can use, you see. The more evidence you have, the less you can use your imagination. And believe me, there's a lot of room, tremendous amount of room for imagination in study of human origins because there is so very little evidence available. Now, another factor which is often not taken into account by evolutionists is the natural variability that we have within each species. The human cranial capacity or brain size varies from 1,000 cc's to as much as 2,000 cc's, 1,000 to 2,000, of equal intelligence, equal brightness. The average is about 1,450, but you have that tremendous variability. The teeth will vary tremendously. Some dentists tell me you can't believe the teeth you find in some people. And it's true of many, many different characteristics. Well, often evolutionists have assigned great evolutionary significance to differences that fall well within this natural variability and have failed to take into account, you see, this difference. Now, they may find a few teeth down in Africa and a few teeth up in Asia, and there's a difference in the size. Well, they're placed not only in separate species but in separate genera. When the range falls well within the range of apes and primates in general, the variability, you see. Well, let's remember then all of these variabilities, reasons for confusion and error that might come into the study of human origins. And remember, of course, that these people are absolutely sold on the fact that man has evolved. And they are convinced the evidence has to fit one way or the other and will fit, you see. Let's bear that in mind now as we take a look at the origin of the primates. Next slide, please. Now, evolutionists believe that primates have evolved from insectivores. Man is included within the order primates. Now, careless Linnaeus, the father of taxonomy, the person who first put man in the order primates, was a special creationist. He didn't see any evolutionary significance to these similarities. He assumed God was a master planner. He used a master plan in his creation. And, for example, among the primates, the lemur-like creatures, the monkeys, apes, and men, we have grasping hands. This is a characteristic not found in many other animals, so we've been placed in this group, one reason, because we have grasping hands. Now, the way of life of monkeys, apes, and men require grasping hands, so we have this feature in common. But man, you see, needs that skill and dexterity not found, which would not be necessary for apes and monkeys. So our hands are different, and yet they are similar in many ways. The way of life of primates requires higher intelligence. So we have relatively large brains. That's true. One of the characteristics of primates, relatively large brain. Of course, the cranial capacity of man is nearly three times that of the other primates. The gorilla has an average cranial capacity, probably around 500 cc's, something like that, goes as high as 650, but that's about a third of man. So our cranial capacity is far superior, and our intelligence is far superior to that of these other creatures. And in man and in other primates, we have a poor sense of smell, that is relatively poor. It does very fine for us. We could say we have a fine sense of smell, far as our needs are concerned, far as our way of life. But compare our sense of smell to that of a dog or a cat or something like that, we have a much reduced sense of smell, but we have keen eyesight and keen hearing. Our way of life requires keen hearing and keen eyesight, but not a keen sense of smell. And that's why, then, we have this characteristic, why we share this characteristic in common with these other animals. Well, because of these characteristics we share in common, we've been placed within the order primate. The evolutionists assume that this is a natural grouping, that we can do this because we've come from a common ancestor. Well, the creationist, you see, says something very, very different. Because of similar needs, God, the master planner, the master engineer, has designed the structures and organs to meet these common needs, you see. But we've been placed in the order of primates. Now, where, according to the theory of evolution, the evolutionists, did primates come from? From what group did they evolve? Well, evolutionists would tell you that primates evolved from insectivores, the living members being moles, hedgehogs, and tree shrews. All right, now why does he assume that the primates have evolved from insectivores? Surely he must have some good fossil evidence. Maybe he has a series of transitional forms showing the transition of insectivores to primates, and that's why he has decided that. Well, not quite. Let me quote from the book called Physical Anthropology by A.J. Kelso. Kelso is an evolutionist. He is an anthropologist. This is the second edition of this book, published by J.B. Lippincott of New York in 1974. On page 142 of that book, Dr. Kelso makes the following statement. Quote, "The transition from insectivore to primate is not documented by fossils. The basis of knowledge about the transition is by inference from living forms." Unquote. All right, what have evolutionists done? They can't find any fossil record. They can't find any transitional forms linking primates to anything else. So they look at the primates, they look at monkeys, and they look at the lemur-like creatures. Then they looked out all over all the other animals in the world and tried to decide which animal seems to be closest to the primates. And their decision was the insectivores are the closest. Presto! Then the insectivores are our ancestors. And I have one article in my files in which the author and evolutionist was denying any such connection. But nevertheless, they find no fossil evidence for this inference. There's no transitional forms whatsoever in the fossil record. There is a great big gap, you see. Man has no ancestors then when we get down to this level. Suddenly, primates appear. And by the way, the first primates supposed to be the lemur-like creatures. Supposed to appear in the Paleocene. When primates appear, here you have actually more species and more genera than you do today. All of a sudden you have this outburst of all these species and genera. They are more diversified, more numerous in their categories than they are today. But they do appear abruptly, as they are one of the 32 orders of mammals. There are 32 orders of mammals, and in every case, each order appears abruptly. The bats, as we enumerated this morning, appear abruptly. The hoofed animals, they appear abruptly. And the rodents, the rodents, all of a sudden, here's these rodents. Numerous, diversified, complete. And that's what we find in every case of these 32 orders of mammals, including the primates. Now, you notice the primates, the earliest primates, the so-called prosimians, that is, the lemur-like creatures, are believed, of course, to evolve into the modern prosimians, the lemurs, lorises, and tarsiers. and then also to the other suborder. There's two suborders here, you see, the prosimians and the anthropoids. And this anthropoidia includes apes, monkeys, and men, so we lumped into this here. Now, there's supposed to be a transition of one into the other. Next slide, please. Now, the prosimians, as I point out, are supposed to have evolved into modern prosimians, into monkeys, into the New World monkeys, Old World monkeys, and then the modern apes, and finally, there was a common ancestor of apes and man, probably common ancestor chimp and man, because the evolutionists believe the chimp is probably our nearest cousin. All right, now, supposedly then, starting back there many millions of years ago, these creatures began to evolve, or there was a line evolving down into these different kinds of creatures. They split off, the line split off at various times. Somewhere down along the line, there was a line that split off to the New World monkeys. The New World monkeys are the narrow-nosed monkeys. They're called Platyrrhini. The Platyrrhines are the narrow-nosed creatures. The Catarrhines are the, the Platyrrhines are the broad-nosed monkeys, the broad-nosed creatures. That's the New World monkeys over here in South America. Over in the Old World was the narrow-nosed creatures, the Catarrhines. That includes the Old World monkeys, apes, and men were all the narrow-nosed creatures. And that is supposed to split off later, you see, down somewhere down along the line. Now, do we have transitional forms between the prosimians, the lemur-like creatures, and monkeys and apes? Absolutely. There are absolutely no transitional forms whatsoever. No transitional forms between the lemur-like creatures and the ape-like creatures. None between lemur-like creatures and monkeys. Going back to Kelso's book again, on page 150, we read, quote, "The details of the evolutionary background of the New World monkeys, the Platyrrhini, would doubtless be informative and interesting, but, unfortunately, we know very little about them." Unquote. Very little about them indeed. We know nothing. The first time you see a monkey over in South America, he's a monkey. That's all. He's complete. He's already there, and there are no transitional forms. On page 151, Dr. Kelso says, quote, "Clearly, the fossil documentation of the emergence of the Old World monkeys could provide key insights into the general evolutionary picture of the primates. But, in fact, this record simply does not exist." Unquote. Boom. All of a sudden, here's monkeys. Oh, we're monkeys. Here they are, just like that. No transitional forms. You see, it's just as in that kind of evidence is just as important as the evidence related to man. Monkeys. Apes. Appear abruptly. No transitional form leading back to the so-called prosimian ancestors. Now, of course, in each case, the modern apes are supposed to split off, but we do not find transitional forms. There are some, well, they speculate, and they say, well, maybe this was a common ancestor, maybe this what gave the rise to this, but we do not find the fossil documentation for these speculations. Finally, we come down to this point, supposedly about 30 million years ago, where ape and man shared a common ancestor. So the evolutionists believe then there was this population of a common ancestor of ape and man. Now, we haven't found him yet. He's hypothetical. The common ancestor of ape and man is still hypothetical. They're still looking for him. But they assumed it existed about 30 million years ago. And then, for some reason, a portion of the population split off, became isolated, and evolved down to the chimpanzees. Another portion of this population split off in another direction, somehow became isolated, and evolved all the way down to man. That's what is supposed to have happened. Next slide, please. Well, now, going back then to this assumed common ancestor about 30 million years ago, I'm giving you the dates set on these things by evolutionists. Then the line led down to man was the hominidae. This is supposed to be the family of man. Now, of course, creationists believe that the hominidae, the family of man, includes one species, One genus, that's all. One genus which had one species, Homo sapiens. But evolutionists take a different view of things. They're looking for the intermediate forms between the common ancestor and modern man. Now, the first suggestion, the first possible suggestion that they have to offer is this so-called creature, Ramapithecus, which is supposed to have existed about 10 to 14 million years ago. Rama means Indian. Pithecus means ape. So the original discoverer of this creature believed him to be an ape, and since he's found in India, he called him Ramapithecus, or Indian ape. Then notice that the next possible candidate for our ancestors is Australopithecus, supposedly about 2 to 3 million years ago. So that means then that for this first 25 to 28 to 30 million years, then the only possible suggestion for our ancestor is Ramapithecus. That's all. Finally down to Australopithecus about 2 to 3 million years ago, and then the next thing in line has been suggested is Homo erectus, the Java man, Peking man, about 500,000 to 1 million years ago, and then finally modern man, including Neanderthal. Well, we're going to take a look at Ramapithecus, then Australopithecus, and Homo erectus, and finally Neanderthal man. Next slide, please. Well, there's the reconstruction of Ramapithecus, which appears in the San Diego Museum of Man. And you see he's quite ape-like, and yet they portray him as an upright, in an upright manner. He walks upright, according to this reconstruction. And if you look in the literature from Time Life publications, they show Ramapithecus as an upright creature, quite ape-like, but yet he's requiring some of these man-like characteristics, you see, and they got a nice white beard on him. Maybe he looks like a sage of some kind, a philosopher or something. But he's still quite ape-like. All right, that's a picture you'll see in the Museum of Man in San Diego. Well, let's see what they actually have, Ramapithecus. Next slide, please. Well, there's the actual evidence that is available. That's a handful of teeth and a few fragments of the jaw. That's the only evidence they have. Now, on the basis of that evidence, you couldn't tell whether that creature walked upright or whether he was a knuckle walker. Well, maybe you would know he didn't walk on his belly, I mean crawl on his belly, but at least you wouldn't know whether he walked upright or what he did of it. So they portray this creature as walking upright. They don't have the foggiest notion how he walked. They couldn't tell from nothing. But they show him in that manner because it's so convincing. You see, you start out with an ape and man on one end and ape on the other, and you put this creature sort of where down along somewhere along a line and show him an upright walk, and, you know, that's convincing. That helps convince people that they really have evidence for change of this kind. But all they have is a few teeth, a few fragments of the jaw. Now, the man who discovered this creature, just called him an ape, said he's just simply an ape. But in later years, David Pilbeam and Elwin Simons, two of the world-renowned experts in this area, have reassessed the evidence. Now, the teeth in this creature are ape-like, but Pilbeam and Simons claim that they're somewhat smaller than you find in modern apes. So they have suggested that there may have been a reduction in the size of the teeth, which is one thing you would expect for the evolutionary form. Another thing, you notice that they've arranged the fragments in this parabolic shape. Now over here you see the man palate, the man's palate or jaw, and you see the parabolic shape. Of course, the small front teeth, the incisors there, and the canine teeth, very small. Here in the black is the typical ape's jaw. It is U-shaped, and you see the very large incisors, very large canine, and the gap between the canine tooth and the incisor that you must have to fit the large canine tooth from the other jaw. You find those gaps. Behind that, you see the typical human shape. So they are insisting that, they simply arranged these fragments in that parabolic shape, similar to man, rather than the U-shape, similar to apes. Well, of course, since that's all you have, you got a lot of gaps, a lot of fragments missing, you can wiggle those things, wiggle and waggle them around in about any shape you want. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Eckert, whom I'll referred to very shortly in that very same publication to which I'm going to refer, showed two different reconstructions of a jaw based upon exactly the same evidence by two different evolutionists. They took exactly the same evidence, a fragment of a jaw, and one came up with a very man-like jaw in a parabolic shape like this, and he drew in the teeth that were missing, made them look very man-like like this. The other evolutionist, taking exactly the same evidence, independently, unknown to the other, had reconstructed a jaw in a very ape-like fashion. He arranged it in the U-shape and drew in the teeth to be very ape-like. So, you see, with fragmentary evidence, you can make it look like what you want to, just what you think it probably did look like or should look like. Well, this is what these people have done here. They've merely arranged them in a parabolic shape. Now, Dr. Robert Eckert, in the January 1972 issue of Scientific American, reported the fact that he had made measurements in the teeth of Ramapithecus. He'd taken these teeth and made 24 different measurements. That is, 24 different dimensions. I don't know what all these dimensions are, the length, the breadth of the tooth, the height of the crown, and there's another 21 different measurements that they can make on teeth. And he made all these measurements on the teeth of Ramapithecus. Then he took the teeth of a fossil ape, both to be about contemporary, and he measured all the same 24 different dimensions in the teeth of the fossil ape. He tabulated the dimensions and then calculated the range of differences. Then he went to a population of chimpanzees, one single species, one single population, and he made the same measurements in the 24 dimensions of the teeth of the chimpanzee. He tabulated these measurements, calculated the differences, and he found that, as a matter of fact, the range of differences among the chimpanzees exceeded those between Ramapithecus and the ape, the fossil ape. He therefore concluded, since the difference between Ramapithecus and the fossil ape was no greater, as a matter of fact, actually less, than you could find within a single population of apes, that there was no significant differences between the teeth of Ramapithecus and the ape. He therefore concluded that Ramapithecus was simply an ape, period. That had nothing to do with the evolution of man. And this was a conclusion already by a number of evolutionists. I concluded that Ramapithecus was simply an ape. Furthermore, in recent years, they've reported that there is a baboon in Africa, the Galata baboon, Therapithecus galata, the Galata baboon, a high-altitude baboon, that has teeth that are practically identical to the teeth of Ramapithecus. And I maintain if you got a modern baboon walking around with teeth like that, that you can't make any claims that those teeth have anything to do with the origin of man, that's for sure. So on the basis of all this evidence, we conclude that Ramapithecus was simply an ape. He had nothing to do with man. He was not a man-like ape. He was simply an ape. And in that we find Eckert, who is an evolutionist, who is an anthropologist, he agrees that this creature was nothing but an ape, and there are quite a few other evolutionists who have reached the same conclusion. Well, now, if we cross Ramapithecus off our list, then, that leaves this huge gap, a 30 million year gap. Well, I was going to say between a hypothetical common ancestor, there's hardly a gap there. You don't even have anything to start with. You don't have the common ancestor to start with. But beginning with that assumed common ancestor, a man and ape, going down to Australopithecus, there's about 25 to 30 million years of supposed evolution, and there's no evidence for this supposed evolution. There is a great, big, huge gap there, not documented by any actual fossil evidence. Now that brings us down to Australopithecus. Australopithecines have been the central figure in theories on the origin of man for many, many years. This is the guy that was our ape-like ancestor. He is the man. He is the central figure in all of these ideas on the origin of man. Back in 1924, Dr. Raymond Dart found a skull fragments of a skull down in South Africa. He gave the name Australopithecus to this find. Australo meaning southern, pithecus meaning ape. So it's a southern ape. But Dr. Dart recognized the ape-like nature of the creature, but yet he claimed there was something unusual about it. The front teeth. He said if you compare the size of the front teeth to the cheek teeth, the relative size is smaller in this creature than you find in modern apes. So he claimed there was a reduction, at least in the relative size of the front teeth. And based upon extremely fragmentary evidence, it has been the consensus of evolutionists for quite a few years that this creature walked upright. This is what is still being taught in most colleges and universities, that he did walk upright. Well, now, one thing about it, regardless of what else you can say about this creature, he had an ape-sized brain. The average cranial capacity of Australopithecines is about 500 cc's, well within the range of apes. As I mentioned, the cranial capacity of gorillas goes up to high as 650 cc's. 500 cc's is about the third of man. Now, some have said, well, it isn't the absolute brain size that is important, it's the brain-to-body weight ratio that's important. These creatures were small, so the relative to the body weight, the brain was large, relatively large. Well, that kind of data means absolutely nothing, because the brain-to-body weight ratio varies tremendously among the primates. As a matter of fact, there are some monkeys whose brain-to-body weight ratio exceeds that of man. So that data means absolutely nothing. These creatures had ape-sized brains. There's no question about it. Well down within the range of apes. So they had ape-sized brains. They were grossly ape-like. They were just apes in their appearance. That's all. And we'll see apes, period. Now the next slide will show the first discovery. This is the tongue child, they call it, in juvenile. Now, the juvenile skull of apes is much more manlike than the adult. If you're going to compare this to that of an ape, you must take a juvenile chimpanzee, and there's essentially no difference in this skull and that of a juvenile chimpanzee. Now, this is grossly ape-like, and we'll see the adult was even more pronounced. It's grossly ape-like, but the teeth claimed are unusual, and the front teeth are smaller, the relative size is smaller than you find in a modern ape. Now, there were additional finds, and finally in 1959, Dr. Louis Leakey and his wife Mary found a skull in East Africa, in Tanzania, in which they claimed was uniquely different. No one had ever seen anything like this before, and was very importantly related to the evolution of man. And Leakey became world famous for his discovery of Zingiranthropus, as he called it. He called it Zingiranthropus, Zing meaning East Africa, Anthropus meaning man. So it became known as East Africa Man, and was portrayed in upright fashion and so forth, and sort of hairless, you know, and much more manlike than anything else. And Dr. Leakey became world famous for his discovery of Zingiranthropus. Later on, Dr. Leakey and all other anthropologists concluded that his Zingiranthropus was simply another variety of Australopithecus. It was nothing new at all. He became world famous for finding something someone else had found 40 years before. But by the time this was known, it didn't make a difference. He was world famous anyhow. So the next slide will show the jawbone of this creature. Here's the jawbone of the Australopithecus, or Zingiranthropus as he called it, and you notice that the cheek teeth were very large. Well, my lights quit working. Maybe I should throw it down on the floor and stomp on it. That might make it work. The cheek teeth, as you notice, are very, very large. As a matter of fact, the cheek teeth of this creature, now this creature is only supposed to weigh 60 to 70 pounds, and yet the cheek teeth are as massive as those that you find in a 400-pound gorilla. So he had massive cheek teeth, massive jaw. But it is claimed that the front teeth, as you see in this picture, are smaller than you find in modern apes. The next slide will show the skull of this creature. Here's a reconstruction of this creature by Dr. Leakey. You notice in the top of the skull, you can't see it too well, but there's a sagittal crest or a bony ridge running across the top of the skull that is typical of apes. Very typical of the apes. That is sagittal crest, indicating that he carried his head, by the way, the same way apes do on their spinal column. He has a very large mastoid processes. The forehead is very flat. He has these massive brow ridges, massive jaws, typical ape. Then again, it was claimed that the front teeth are smaller than you find in modern apes. Otherwise, just grossly ape-like. Next slide, we'll show on the left the gracile form of this creature, on the right, the gorilla. And again, you see the very great similarity between this creature and that of the gorilla and other apes. Now, this creature did not have a sagittal crest. Now, Dr. Leakey claimed that this gracile form was the form that eventually gave rise to man. The robustus form simply died out, did not leave any evolutionary offspring. Richard Leakey, in some of his publications, since he found this form together with the robustus form, contemporary, claimed that this was merely the female and the robustus was the male of the same species. I noticed in his last publication he is sort of drifting back to his father's assessment that they were separate species. But this is a grossly ape-like, very much similar to the apes. Now, in recent years, some prominent evolutionists, scientists, have produced evidence that this creature did not walk upright and that he was not intermediate between ape and man. You see, one of the evidence supposedly indicating this creature was our ancestor is the fact that he walked upright. This is what everybody's been teaching. As a matter of fact, in Philadelphia recently, in a meeting there, a young lady came to me and says, I'm a creationist, but I've been studying these things over there at the university. I have seen them. And I know that this creature, the pelvis and so forth, is similar to that of man, indicating that he walked upright. I can just tell by looking at him. Well, it's an amazing thing how even an expert could just look at something and claim that it walked upright, claim it was similar to man. That's really amazing. But when some college student can claim she can look at bones and just tell the creature walked upright, that is really utterly amazing. As a matter of fact, I have with me an article by Sir Solly Zuckerman. Sir Solly is a famous British anatomist. And he reports in this article, was published in a journal of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, volume 11, January 1966. In this article, Sir Solly says, I have had a team of scientists studying this creature, these australopithecines, for 15 years. We have used the method of multivariate analysis, a very complex analysis. You look at a pelvis, for example, and you make many different measurements. You plot this on a three-dimensional diagram. Then you rotate the pelvis. You make another series of measurements, plot them on your three-dimensional diagram, and you rotate it to many different angles. You do that, and you get all kinds of points. Then you take the pelvis of a man. You do the same thing, and the monkeys, and the apes. And you get all this data, tremendous data, so much of this data that you have to use a computer to analyze it. Well, he said, they have used this method. He has had a team of scientists working on this creature for 15 years. And he says every answer we get contradicts what is popularly said about this creature. What is everybody is saying, what they're teaching about this creature, our data contradicts that data. Our data indicates that this creature did not walk upright, that he was not intermediate between ape and man, that he carried his skull on the top of his head just like apes, and the analysis of the hand bones, the foot bones, the pelvis, and everything, and the teeth, and the cranium, and the skull and everything indicates that this creature was not intermediate, just simply an ape. And he practically sat down and cried. He says, I've been publishing this material, it's good data, and nobody pays one bit of attention to me. Everybody goes on and just keeps saying this creature's intermediate, our ancestors, and our data indicates absolutely this is not true. But nobody would pay any attention to Sir Solly. Well, now, just recently, in Nature, the British Science Journal, volume 258, December 4th, 1975, we find an article by Charles E. Oxnard. Dr. Oxnard is professor of anatomy, professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. And in this article, he repeats precisely what Sir Solly had said 10 years ago. He said that his multivariate analysis of australopithecines showed that they did not walk upright. They were not intermediate between ape and man. The study of the pelvis, the study of the hand bones, the study of the foot bones indicated that this creature had a mode of locomotion similar to orangs, a hanging, climbing mode of locomotion, not a knuckle walker, similar to the gorillas and the chimpanzees, not upright like man, but like orang, that swing through the trees. They climb up the branches and then they swing, and so they have a hanging, climbing mode of locomotion. He says our analysis indicates that this was a mode of locomotion of this creature. It indicates he was not intermediate between ape and man. He said, now this creature is not related to anything living today. It wasn't related to any modern apes, not related to man. He just simply uniquely himself. But he said, if you have to compare it to anything living today, he's more similar to an orang than anything else. Well, here the data is now. It's in print and it's in Nature. It cannot be ignored anymore. And I'll bet you, if you go to practically any college and university around in this area and you ask them about Australopithecus, they'll say, oh yeah, he walked upright. We got evidence for that. We know he walked upright. And they haven't even read this material. They're not even familiar with it. They just go read an anthropology book, you see. It was written by some who read another anthropology book. It was written 10 or 15 years before that. And they don't read this material. When I was at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo for a debate, we had a tremendous crowd that evening for this debate, and I was debating a professor of anthropology there at that university, and she based much of her case on evolution on Australopithecus. Here she showed all these charts and all these slides of Australopithecus and so-called succession on up to man, and here she was, professor of anthropology, teaching this material to her students, and I got up in the rebuttal, brought out this material, pointed out that these experts, they're evolutionists, as pointed out that this creature did not walk upright, he was not intermediate. And that left her just flat-footed. She just didn't know what to do. She had no rebuttal, and it just completely shot her case to pieces. But still, just like I met this young girl here at Philadelphia, she wasn't familiar with any of this. She had never heard of it. She could just look at that thing and tell it walked upright. Well, that's absolute nonsense. And that's what Sir Solly is saying in his article. He entitles it Myths and Methods in Anatomy. He says there's myths and then there's method. Some people just say they can look at something. They just look at it and get their practiced eye on it and say, well, that looks like that's the same as man. So it walked upright. And so forth and so on. He says that's the myths. The methods is you make all kinds of measurements. You make all the detailed measurements. That's the objective, cold data. Now you analyze it as carefully as possible, and the answer comes up just the opposite. You say, that's the methods in anatomy. And he said, we ought to use methods instead of the myths. And when you use methods, it turns out this creature is not intermediate. He had nothing to do with the evolution of man. And I think, as we'll find, there's more and more data to support that. And I think we can just take this creature and cross him right off the page. Just cross him right off the picture here. He's not intermediate. He didn't have anything to do with the evolution of man. He was not in the line leading to man, definitely. Now, the next possible candidate is a famous Java man, Peking man, now put together in one single species, Homo erectus. Back in about 1890, Eugene Dubois, Dr. Dubois, a Dutch physician, now he was an evolutionist, he felt man had evolved, he's sure man had evolved, and somehow he concluded that man had evolved down in the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia. So he wanted to go down to the Dutch East Indies and start looking for the missing link. Well, the way he managed to do it, he joined the Dutch army, so he'd get an assignment to Indonesia, to the Dutch East Indies. So sure enough, he joined the Dutch army, they signed him down there to Indonesia at his request, and he began his search for the missing link. And would you believe it? In 1 year, he'd found his missing link. He found the evolutionary form of man, Pithecanthropus erectus, or the erect ape man. down there along the Solo River in Indonesia, he found a skull cap. And about a year later, and 50 feet away, he found a femur, the large leg bone or thigh bone, shown in the next slide. Well, here's your famous Pithecanthropus erectus, or the famous Java man, the skull cap and the femur. There is no question that that is a human femur. It's identical. There's no difference. There's no difference between that femur and the femur of any human. Well, the people looked at it. Some of them looked at the skull cap and said, well, that's just an ape. Others looked at the femur and said, well, that's just man. Others looked at the femur and the skull cap and put them together, and well, what'd you have? You had the ape man, you see. That's precisely what Marcellin Boule, B-O-U-L-E is the way he spelled the name, Boule, the great French expert on skulls. I'm going to bring him in later. Marcellin, that's M-A-R-C-E-L-L-I-N. Marcellin Boule, great French expert on skulls. He looked at this data and said, well, if you looked at skull cap, you just say ape. If you look at the femur, you say man. And so, you see, you conclude you have an ape man. Well, now, right from the very start, and still today, some evolutionists question whether that femur went with the skull cap at all. Say it was a human femur. Didn't have anything to do with the owner of the skull cap. And I think undoubtedly that's the case. It was a human femur. Found in a loose gravel deposit. Had nothing to do with the owner of the skull cap. But Eugene Dubois did claim that they went together. And by the way, he found three teeth also. Two of the teeth turned out to be from an orang. And the third turned out to be undoubted human too. So they didn't have anything to do with the owner of the skull cap either. And neither did the femur. Well, he won most of the evolutionists to his side, and they have accepted this as the predecessor of man. Supposed to be about 500,000 to 1,000,000 years old. They don't know. They just guesstimated that he's probably 500,000 years old or so. Well, funny thing about it is about 15 years before he died, Dubois concluded this creature had nothing to do with the ordinary man, that he was just a giant gibbon. But by this time, he'd convinced most evolutionists, and they didn't believe him. And so here's a strange thing: the discovery of the creature finally concluded he's nothing but an ape. And in the meantime, the evolutionists, they concluded now that he was the ape-like ancestor of man. Well, later on in the 20s, the first discovery in China, near Peking, China, was out of a single tooth. And Dr. Davidson Black, a medical doctor at the Union Medical College in Peking, boldly he struck out on the basis of that one single tooth and constructed a whole man around that tooth, Sinanthropus pekinensis, or the Peking Chinese man. And later on, they found fragments of 40 different individuals. All of these fragments, practically all the fragments, were from the skulls and the lower jaws. They found practically nothing of the postcranial skeleton. Furthermore, the skulls had been crushed in the back so that the brains could be extracted and eaten. Everybody concluded that every one of these individuals had been killed and eaten. The skulls and lower jaws were transported to the site where they were found because they didn't find any of the rest of the skeleton there. They did not die where they were found, because only the skulls and the lower jaws were found there. Now, this is supposed to be on a limestone cliff. It was on a limestone cliff. Supposedly was a lower cave where they found most of these remains. At a so-called upper cave, they found genuine human remains. Well, now, some people have very serious doubt whether there was a cave at either side. But this has always been the claim. Had to be some massive cave there then, because the bones were scattered out over an area 100 yards broad, 100 yards wide, that's some cave. But anyhow, that was the claim. Now, there were tools on the site. Marcellin Boule, this great French expert who went there to study these bones, by the way, he went there, and well, before I bring in that part of the story, I want to relate the fact that the early description of this creature were quite ape-like. And they were described in ape-like terms. But as time went on, the reports seemed to get more and more manlike, so that the later reports actually contradicted the early reports. The real evolution of this creature seemed to be in the evolution of the reports rather than the evolution of the creature itself. Finally, Weidenreich, a German paleontologist, went there in 1936. And again, as time went on, his reports began to get more and more manlike. And finally, the models from Weidenreich would reach the outside world, shown in the next slide, and it's quite manlike. Next slide. Here's the model of Peking Man by Weidenreich. Now, this is a model. There's no bone there, not a single bone. This is just a clay model or whatever he used for it, plaster, Paris, or clay or something. This is his model that he shipped out of the country. And you can see, while it did have the massive eyebrow ridges, and some features that are quite primitive, and yet it's sort of man-like in it. I'd have to admit that creature is just about man, you see. But this picture contradicts the early descriptions of this creature. That makes it very, very suspicious. Now, Marcel Lamboule, this great French expert who went over to Peking, China, actually studied these bones and studied the tools that were found on the site, said, and he published this in his book, now he's an evolutionist, but he says, the owner of that monkey-like skull could not possibly have manufactured the tools there on the site. But he said, these creatures have been killed and eaten. All right, the question is then, who was the hunter? Now, Weidenreich and other evolutionists claimed he was both the hunter and the hunted. He was a cannibal, and he had eaten his enemies, or friends, or something, and preserved their skulls and lower jaws as trophies. That was the explanation by Weidenreich and others to salvage the case. Well, Marcel Lamboule said that he and others, and I don't know who he means by others, but he said he and others preferred to believe on the basis of all the evidence that the hunter that killed and ate this creature was true man. Man himself, modern man, that is true man, killed and ate these creatures. Now you can't have man eating his own ancestors. That's ridiculous. And if Boole is right, and he was an evolutionist, he was an expert, he did study the evidence, he's right, then this creature cannot be our ancestor. This creature must be, just as Dubois claimed for his Java man, a giant gibbon or a giant ape or something of that kind. Now his cranial capacity is higher than you find in modern apes. But we have giant creatures of all kinds and descriptions, from giant dragonflies with 3-foot wingspread to the giant sloths, the giant mammoths, giant everything. And I don't think it's hardly inconceivable that we had giant primates in the past. But anyhow, they're very ape-like. So ape-like that Marcel Lamboule said he could not possibly have made the tools. That he was simply the victim. The victim had been killed and eaten by man himself. Others have suggested, and this is a creationist now I mentioned now, Patrick O'Connell, a Roman Catholic priest who was there in China, read all the reports, analyzed all the data, noticed how the reports got more and more manlike, and he said what had happened, men were in there mining that area for calcium carbonate, limestone, and there was all these stones there, quartz, had to be carried in from some distant site because quartz is not found there. They're black on one side, indicating they'd been part of a kiln. And what people were doing, they were mining that area for limestone, burning it to convert it to lime to use in building houses. They had killed and ate these creatures, carried the skulls and the lower jaws there as trophies, and the mining had undermined the cliff. It collapsed and buried these skulls and the human beings, which were found up there above in the so-called upper cave. Actually, he said there's no evidence of any cave there at all. Well, I think that's a very reasonable picture. I am convinced that at least these creatures, so-called Peking Man and Java Man, were not man. They were not anything related to man, but they were just simply some giant apes or something of that kind. Now, in support of that, Dr. Louis Leakey, had reported, I should say this first of all, that Dr. Leakey claimed that he found a creature very similar to Australopithecus, but more manlike. He called it Homo habilis, handyman. Well, many evolutionists have completely rejected this assessment by Dr. Leakey. They say Homo habilis was nothing but Australopithecus, just a variety of Australopithecus. That's what the majority of evolutionists have concluded. But Dr. Leakey said, no, Australopithecus, Homo habilis, and then Homo habilis evolved into Homo erectus. But there in bed two of the Olduvai Gorge, Dr. Leakey reports that he found the remains of Australopithecus, Homo habilis, and Homo erectus all together in the same bed, contemporary. And at the bottom of bed one, which is under bed two, he found the remains of a circular stone habitation hut, which is an artifact of true man. Now, that seems rather strange, doesn't it? How can one be the ancestor of the other when they're all there together, and how could they be the ancestor of man when an artifact of man is found underneath? Well, I think that lends weight to this idea that this creature certainly was not man's ancestor, but was simply an ape. Now, the bones upon which this model is based are not available. They became, during the war, according to the story, they finally decided they better try to ship those bones out of China. They boxed them up, sent them to a marine detachment, and that's the last anybody ever saw the bones. That's the story, at least. Now, Patrick O'Connell claims that Dr. Pai, P-E-I, the Chinese anthropologist there, paleontologist, deliberately destroyed the bones so that they would not be made known to outside scientists. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. At least that's what he claimed. It was a cover-up, you know. Somebody erased the tapes, erased the fossils, and there was a giant cover-up here, paleontological Watergate. Well, I don't know if that's happened or not, but that's what's suggested. At least we can say this. This is hearsay evidence. It's not admissible in a court of law. Well, it's admissible in evolution. Anything is admissible. But this would not be admissible in a court of law. If a creationist tried to present something like this, it would simply be thrown out. Well, that brings us down to the Neanderthal man. Next slide, please. We'll show the original description of Neanderthal man. Fragments of this creature were found beginning about 1860. And then in 1908, they found a nearly complete skeleton in France. And it's upon this skeleton that the type Neanderthal is based. And from the appearance of the skeleton, it looked like he couldn't walk upright. He just looked like he was kind of half, part way up. He's on the way up, you see. And he had a sort of a beetle brow and stooped shoulders and so forth. So Neanderthal man for nearly a century or so was portrayed as this stooped over, bent-kneed, beetle-browed, long-armed, knuckle-dragging, stoop-shouldered, bow-legged subhuman called Homo Neanderthalensis. He was judged to be our subhuman ancestor. Well, there was a famous anatomist at that time said, now just a minute, fellows, the skeleton on which you are basing the type Neanderthal is from an arthritic old man. The reason he didn't walk upright is very simple. He's an old man and had a very bad case of arthritis. That's the only reason he didn't walk upright. Well, evolutionists never paid any attention to this anatomist. After all, this was a picture they wanted, and so this is a picture that appeared. I took this from that same 1937 issue of Life magazine. Well, it was established later on that this was an arthritic old man. They found other skeletons of Neanderthal man fully erect. They found skeletons of Neanderthal man contemporary with undoubted modern man. They found from x-rays of bones and teeth of these creatures that every one of them suffered from rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency. And they have now concluded that all these so-called primitive features of Neanderthal man were not genetic, but they were pathological, they were environmental, they were nutritional. Had nothing to do with genetics. And now they conclude that Neanderthal man is just as human as you and I. And the modern version appears in the next slide. This is obtained from the Chicago Museum of Natural History. And an article that appeared about 10 years ago said if you just give this creature a shave and a haircut and a bath and put him in a business suit, no one would hardly take a second look. Well, of course, 10 years later now, you wouldn't have to give him a shave or a haircut. And he'd fit in pretty nicely. I'm sure that's not true of Calvary Chapel here, but in some circles you wouldn't even have to give him a bath, and he'd fit in very nicely. Well, he is now judged to be fully human, Homo sapiens, and he's classified as Homo sapiens. And he's no longer our subhuman ancestor, you see. He's just Homo sapiens, just like you and I. So we lost Neanderthal man
as our ancestor.
By the way, according to the evolutionary chronology, what they say, he appears abruptly in Europe about 100,000 years ago. Nobody knows where he came from, how he got there. Abruptly, 35,000 years ago, he disappears, and he's replaced by Cro-Magnon.
Cro-Magnon
man is indistinguishable from modern
Europeans.
So he appears, suddenly goes away,
suddenly,
and nobody knows where he came from or where he went. But undoubtedly he was modern man.
Well,
we lost Neanderthal man as our ancestor.
We lost
Nebraska man as our ancestor.
We lost
Piltdown man as our ancestor. We've lost Australopithecines as our ancestor. And now it looks like we've lost
everything
as our ancestor. In recent publications,
the last few years,
Richard Leakey, for example, the son of the famous Dr. Leakey, claimed that he's found the fossils of man older than all of our assumed ancestors. Now, I'm telling you what dates they give using the potassium-argon method, which we believe
simply will not work
because there's no way of knowing whether there was any argon in the rock to begin with. And you get
all kinds of dates.
You get some dates that are very old,
and rocks are known to be
quite young by this method.
But anyhow,
using this method, they had dated Australopithecus at about 2 million years.
They didn't chance
it was supposed to be about 1.75 million years. Some been dated recently as 1 million years, perhaps some as old as 3 million years, something like that. But it's dated around 2-3 million years, something like that. Our ape-like ancestor. The Homo erectus, the Java man, Piki man, is supposed to be, you know, guesstimated at around 0.5 million to 1 million years old. But now Richard Leakey has found what he calls the fossil of man, 3 million years old. Well, you've got some problem here, fellas. We've got man older than his ancestors. And that's kind of difficult, you see. It's pretty difficult to imagine how the parents can be younger than the children. I've never heard of a case like that yet. I heard Richard Leakey lecture in San Diego, and he said, "What I have discovered simply demolishes all theories on the origin of man." And he said, and I heard him say it, he says, "I have nothing to put in their place." In other words, since I've got man older than all of these assumed ancestors, they can't be our ancestors, and I don't have any other ancestors to supply. Well, I think this data simply indicates that man, monkeys, and apes have always been distinctly separate, that one did not evolve from the other. Well, what are evolutionists going to make of this data? Well, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of the ranks of the evolutionists. We've already got some interesting data. Now, this is my only authority for this, but I have in my hands a reprint of an article which appeared in Modern People, Volume 8, April 18th, 1976, on page 11. I don't know anything about this publication. But here's an article which is quoting Jeffrey Bourne, Dr. Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E, Dr. Jeffrey Bourne, the director of the Yerkes Primate Research Center of Emory University. His way out of this difficulty, he says, is that man did not evolve from apes, but apes evolved from man. He's got it just twisted around, you see. And he says this data of Richard Leakey, which indicates man is older than these creatures, must mean that then apes evolved from man. That's what he says here. And here's interesting. Now, we know this old embryological recapitulation data is worthless anyhow, but listen to what he says here. Another argument the doctor, who is considered one of the world's leading experts on primates, uses to support his theory is the fact that an ape fetus, that is the embryo, the ape fetus looks like a human fetus during the early stages of development before its birth. It is only in the later stages of gestation that the unborn ape starts developing typical ape-like characteristics. Now, what's he saying? Well, you look at an ape embryo when it's still quite immature, it looks like a human. And then as it develops further, it looks more ape-like. Now, that proves, you see, that apes evolved from man because the ape fetus looks like a human and then it develops into an ape. Isn't it strange? Evolution has always been claiming just the reverse, that the human fetus looks like an ape, and then it looks more like man. Well, it just demonstrates how ridiculous this whole thing is. But here is a scientist now saying that apes must have evolved from man. That explains all the problems. Well, I don't know how many are going to buy that. I'll tell you one thing, I don't buy it. It's bad enough to think that man evolved from ape, but think that apes evolved from man. Well, maybe if you asked an ape about that, he'd probably say yes. He might say, well, man descended, all right, but he sure didn't descend from us. We're not that stupid. Do all the dumb things that man has done. Well, I think this evidence indicates simply that man is a special creation. We were created in the image of God. We didn't descend from any lower creature, a sin, whatever you want to look at. We've been separately and directly created, and indeed we were created in the image of man, and we are responsible to God, our Creator.
This is the end of cassette 855D.